I was faced with a situation where there was going to be a meeting where polygamy was discussed, and someone felt that I should go to that meeting. So anyway, once the decision was made that I was going to go to that meeting, then I had to study this topic with diligence. Before, it was sort of a topic to think about, and now it was a topic to really think about. It's like, what is the answer to this? So I began to collect biblical data. You know, I've found that if there are times you come to a subject or to a passage that you don't know what the answer is, you just start writing down all the things you can find in the Bible that relate to the topic. Just write it down. And then when you write those things down, then you start to sort of say, well, what is this all about? Well, looks like this, that's talking about this, and this is talking about this. You begin to organize in your mind, and as you begin to do that, clarity begins to emerge. So, let's begin by affirming together what we agree on. God's standard of marriage is the joining of one man and one woman. And in the New Testament era, remarriage after divorce is adultery. And polygamy is a great evil, as evidenced both by Scripture and by observation of its practice. And the only question is, what about if a mission moves into a culture that polygamy already exists? Should polygamous marriages be allowed to continue as people become part of the church? So let's consider what the Old Testament has to say. It's very clear that in the Old Testament era, polygamy was not counted as adultery. Believers were not censured for their polygamy. Jacob, for example, was never censured as an adulterer. In fact, God closed Rachel's womb because Jacob hated Leah, Genesis 29:31. It was not because he was specifically married to a second wife. And then later, Genesis 30:22, God opened Rachel's womb in relation to prayer. Ruth 4:11, there's a blessing on Ruth which mentions Rachel in addition to Leah. And this would be a very strange thing if the relationship to Rachel was adultery. Also, an illegitimate child could not enter the congregation of the Lord to the 10th generations. And if the polygamy was adultery, then half of Jacob's sons would have been illegitimate. Furthermore, David is never censured for his polygamy, but he is severely judged for his adultery. And then in addition to that, the legal regulations of the Mosaic Law accepted polygamy. Polygamy is notably absent from the sexual sin lists in the Old Testament. For example, adultery in Leviticus 18:20 and chapter 20:10, homosexuality, Leviticus 20:13, incest, Leviticus 18:6-18, and bestiality, Leviticus 18:23. There were punishments for adultery and harlotry, but not for polygamy. Adulterers were to be executed, Leviticus 20:10. Stoning was specified for the case in Deuteronomy 22:23-24. And the daughter of a priest who profaned her father's ministry by harlotry was to be burnt with fire, Leviticus 21:9. It's also clear that God regulated the practice of polygamy. For example, God did not allow a husband to bypass the actual firstborn for offspring of a favorite wife, clearly allowing the multiple wife situation to continue, Deuteronomy 21:15-17. And then there was full marriage rights for a slave wife even after he would take another wife, Exodus 21:10. Also, it's interesting to notice that in the Old Testament, affairs with single girls did not count as adultery. A man who seduced a virgin was required to marry her, and certainly this requirement was not limited to single men, Deuteronomy 22:28-29. God's command for levirate marriage, that is, a brother marrying his sister-in-law after his brother had died without having children, was not counted as adultery. Now, the command probably had in view an unmarried brother living with his married brother, because it begins by saying, if brothers dwell together. That's Deuteronomy 25:5-6. And so the point is not conclusive because we don't know the circumstances of the brothers. But if brothers were dwelling together, it seems likely that one of them would be single, and this would still fit with God's plan of one man for one woman. It's just that the younger brother must do a special service for his deceased brother. And examples of existing levirate marriage, never explicitly polygamy. Judah's youngest son, for whom Tamar was waiting, was not married. And this also fits with the wording of the trick question by the Pharisees to Jesus in Matthew 22, verses 23 to 28. The first brother took a wife, then the second, then the third, then the fourth, down to the youngest. And the younger ones would be less likely to be married. So the conclusion is, you can't conclusively claim that levirate marriage in the Old Testament demanded polygamy, but even if it did, polygamy was not counted as adultery in the Old Testament. Now notice the self-consistency of the Old Testament. Polygamy is not counted as adultery. Having concubines is not counted as adultery. Remarriage after divorce is not counted as adultery. And the behavior of the divorced and remarried was regulated. She was not stoned. That's Deuteronomy 24. So multiple partners for the husband is not counted as adultery in the Old Testament. However, when you get to the New Testament, you find the situation changes. Because the New Testament, Jesus teaching in the Gospels, expands the definition of adultery. Remarriage after divorce is explicitly called adultery. A man can commit adultery against his own wife. Now, this was unheard of in the Old Testament. You see, a man committed adultery in the Old Testament by taking someone else's wife. He was not committing adultery by taking an additional wife or by having an affair with a single girl. And so, in Mark chapter 10, verse 11, Jesus said that whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. That was a new idea for the Jews. And notice that this would be true if he merely adds another wife without putting his first away. If it's adultery to divorce your wife and marry another, if it's adultery against her, then certainly it would be adultery against her if you married another without divorcing your wife. Paul's commands in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 to 5, are impossible for a polygamist to fulfill. Each person is to have his own spouse, verse 2, exclusive. And this is a statement that Bible scholars have long recognized as a statement against polygamy. Calvin, for example, hundreds of years ago saw that. Each has his own husband. The wife of a polygamist does not have a husband, just her own. Verse 3 of that chapter, the obligation to render affection that's due. A man who takes a second wife automatically separates himself from his first wife by forming that new union. Calvin saw that years ago. Verse 4, the obligation of both spouses to give the other spouse complete control of their own body. Well, clearly, when a man marries an additional wife, he ceases to give his first wife authority over his body, at least part of the time. And he also ceases as long as he continues with the second wife. Also, the New Testament terminology and its use of singular and plural regarding spouses. Sometimes, the New Testament speaks of husbands, plural, and wives, plural. That is, a group of men who are married. But whenever it's a husband singular, it always speaks of a wife singular. Now, how do we understand the contrast between the Old Testament and the New Testament? There are sins connected with taking a second wife in the New Testament. The act of taking a second wife, what are they? A person is refusing Jesus' standard of taking man back to creation and God's intention of having only one man for one woman. He looks on another and desires her. Jesus said, whoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery. It's not loving your wife as yourself. Would you, after all, like your wife to take an additional husband? It's not loving your present wife as Christ loves the church. It's a bad testimony for unbelievers. And taking an additional wife mars the symbolism of Christ in the church. Inevitably, it will bring disharmony and rivalry into the home. And it disqualifies a man for eldership in the church. Now, if you continue with this second wife, it would continue to mar the church Christ symbolism. Christ, after all, is not devoting himself to two brides. It's impossible to exclusively love his wife like Christ loved the church, because he has two. It would be impossible to fully give his body to either wife as required in 1 Corinthians 7. Well, let's look at the contrast in the Old and New Testament regarding the definition of adultery. The Old Testament definition: a man committed adultery only by taking his neighbor's wife. And a woman committed adultery only by having relations with a man not her husband. What did not count as adultery? Well, starting polygamy, continuing polygamy, having concubines, looking at a single woman and lusting after her, affairs with single girls, remarriage after divorce. Those things were not counted as adultery in the Old Testament. It's interesting to notice that Proverbs speaks against being ensnared by a married woman. And the focus is not on the desire for her, as the New Testament is, but on the foolishness of getting ensnared by her. And again, the Old Testament is focusing on the relationship with a married woman. If you read Proverbs, you'll see it's talking about going after your neighbor's wife, which is such a foolish thing. The New Testament is broader, and it's the same for men and women. Remarriage after divorce, extramarital affairs, even looking and lusting, and you can't start a polygamous relationship. Now, I believe that consistency prohibits any polygamy in the New Testament era. There is consistency in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, men were permitted to have multiple partners in various situations: remarriage after divorce, polygamy, concubines, etc. The Old Testament is consistent with itself. There is consistency in the New Testament. Jesus clearly prohibits multiple wives in divorce and remarriage cases. And you notice the self-consistency of the Old Testament has changed now. Consistency with this no remarriage command of Christ would not allow multiple marriage, even if there is no divorce. In other words, Jesus, by his statements, effectively forbids polygamy. Looking on a woman to lust after her without divorcing your wife is adultery. And hence, additional marriage without divorcing a present wife would also be adultery. As a polygamist continues to look on and desire his new wife, he commits adultery against his first wife. If remarriage after divorce is adultery, then certainly remarriage without divorce would be adulterous also. And the ultimate answer, of course, is this. In the New Testament, remarriage is not permitted, not because of divorce, but because a person is already married. Any polygamous union is adultery because for wife number two, the man is already married. Now, how important is this area of consistency? There are two aspects of consistency, and we often hear of the one. And that is, oh, something is inconsistent. Let's apply our principle more consistently. Here we haven't been applying it quite right. We'll modify this so we're consistent. That is one use of consistency, and it's important. But there's another use that's hardly ever spoken of and is even more important, and that is, inconsistency is evidence that the principle you were following was indeed false when you thought it was true. Let me give you an example of this. In mathematics, there are various things that are difficult to prove, but they are clearly true. And there are some of these things that are so hard to prove if you try to go about it directly. But if you go about it indirectly, it becomes really quite easy. For example, how many of you have ever heard that in arithmetic, you must not divide by zero? You ever heard that? Okay. One or two people have. It's true. You must not divide by zero. That is a principle of mathematics. You must not do that. If you do that, you introduce all kinds of confusion and disaster into your program. Now, how would you prove that? How would you prove that you cannot divide by zero? That seems a little harder, doesn't it? Actually, the proof is very easy. You do something called indirect proof. Here's how it works. Let's take 4 times 0 is equal to what? 0. So that would be the same as 8 times 0, right? Do you agree with that statement? 4 times 0 equals 8 times 0. So now, let's try this. See, now we're assuming you can divide by zero now. Let's just assume you can divide by zero. So we divide this side by zero and this side by zero. And what do we get? 4 equals what? 8. That didn't look too good, does it? In fact, that's a big contradiction. Inconsistency right there. Now, how did we ever get into this mess? We got into this mess by assuming you could divide by zero. What does that tell you? You can't divide by zero. End of proof. Isn't that neat? So now you all know you can't divide by zero. Never do it. It's bad. Okay. You see, this is one of the things you can do to show that a principle that people believe in is false. Say, okay, suppose it's true. And if it's true, it implies this and this and this, and you get to a big contradiction. You say, ah, big mess. How did we ever get there? We got there because we started out with this assumption that it was true, which must mean it must be false, which means that principle can't be. Now, in Scripture, Jesus used this method. You remember these folks didn't believe in the resurrection? He said, haven't you ever read at the incident of Moses in the bush? God said, I am a God of the living. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God is a God of the living, not of the dead. What's he doing? He's saying, well, suppose there's no resurrection. If there's no resurrection, and God said at the time of Moses, when Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were already dead, I am a God of the living. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, rather. He wouldn't be a God of the living. He'd be a God of whom? The dead. Contradiction. Therefore, your position that there's no resurrection must be false. So, the consistency of the Old Testament and the consistency in the New Testament fits with God's character. He is not a God of confusion. In the Old Testament, multiple partners are allowed for men. In the New Testament or the New Covenant, they are not. In time past, God overlooked some things, but now commands all men everywhere to repent, Acts 17:30. So, how do you deal with this? What if you're involved in missions and there are people that are polygamous? I believe that we have to recognize the errors that will come with allowing existing polygamy to continue for those who profess Christ. Because if you allow existing polygamy to continue, it will bring you into conflict with the New Testament. What should be done if a polygamist has 3 wives and one of them is a divorcee? Now, if one of those wives is a divorcee, according to the New Testament, he would have no right to have that person as his wife. But if you appeal to the Old Testament, one of those wives as a divorcee makes no problem. You're going to either be inconsistent with the Old Testament or inconsistent with the New Testament. You cannot be picking and choosing and taking part out of one covenant and part out of the other covenant. You're either in the Old Covenant or you're in the New Covenant. Now, in polygamous societies, one of the things you will find is that there is divorce and remarriage. There will be somebody gets divorced and then some other polygamist will pick up that woman in marriage. And so, you'll find that where churches have allowed for existing polygamy, they automatically embrace existing divorce and remarriage. And this is not just an African problem. There are Mormons in this country who have multiple wives. And I remember in September of 2005, I was holding meetings at a Sri Lankan church up in Toronto, and the pastor there said that he needed to face the polygamy issue in Canada because of a new convert that had a couple of wives. What was he to do? It's not just an African problem. I believe it's impossible to tell the divorced and remarried person, look, you can't be living with this second woman, and at the same time telling this man who didn't divorce his first one and married the second one and third one, you can keep all of your additional wives. You see, allowing existing polygamy demands allowing existing remarriage. Otherwise, you have 2 classes in the church. You have classes of those who can have multiple wives, and you have classes of those who cannot. So, I believe that a man who is a polygamist would need to be received into the church in the sense of he would have to separate from any adulterous relationships, the same as a man who's been divorced and remarried would need to separate from adulterous relationships. And it isn't like saying, well, come on into the church, and we hope that in 10 years you'll see it differently. You know, in Ezra, they said, come back in 3 days. This is something that you have to deal with in seriousness and immediacy. I believe that a polygamist should remain with his first legitimate wife. If his first wife was a divorcee, then what? He had no right to her. You see, we're right back to that chart again. It becomes self-consistent. His first wife is a divorcee, and the second wife was a woman that was unattached. He had no right to the first wife, but he would have right and responsibility to the second wife. If he had a legitimate first wife that he had divorced, then he could not remain with any of his subsequent wives. Again, it's consistent with that remarriage after divorce. I believe that such a person should support all of his wives and teach all of his children, and the church would need to take active steps to help take up the slack in these difficult situations, just like sometimes families in America have these kind of difficult situations in terms of divorce and remarriage, and the church needs to help take up some of the slack to help relieve some of the burden of how it all works out. Such a person, I believe, a polygamist, former polygamist, would not be eligible for church leadership, like we talked about earlier regarding 1 Timothy 3:2, because he would not be a one-woman man regarding entanglements. Now, in Africa, up in Niger, a nomadic tribal group, they have two types of marriage. One they call kubgal, and that is a wedding arranged by the parents in the proper way with the normal exchange of bride price, the sanction of the community, and a bride and groom that are free from prior relationships. But there's another kind of marriage called tigal, and it's the practice of wife stealing. You go to a clan gathering and you flirt with the women and convince one of them to abandon her husband and run off with you. Naturally, the husband tends to object. So there's probably going to be a sword fight, but since you're macho and tough, you win and gain popular admiration. In fact, being a real man is measured in part by how many tigals you have accomplished. Now imagine, in that culture, would you allow a man to continue with wives he has stolen? After all, that culture says that's legitimate. And similarly, a culture that says taking multiple virgins is legitimate. You know what we have to do? We've got to all come back and kneel down before this book, the New Testament covenant, and follow what the New Testament has to say. John Patton was a missionary to the South Sea Cannibals back in the 1800s. And he saw clearly the impossibility of allowing one to come into the church with two wives while not allowing a member to take two wives. That's the kind of dichotomy that some mission organizations are trying to do these days. Say, well, you know, if you come in with existing polygamy, we don't like it, but then if someone in the fellowship would take an additional wife, that cannot be. You know, you cannot tell this man in the church, you can have three wives right here in the church, and this fellow over here, he can't. I talked to a man regarding a polygamy issue that had experience. He lived in Kenya for 6 years, and he was involved in the mission program for 10 years. One of the confrontations they got into, there was a brother that got saved, and he wanted to be baptized. Then they found out that he had four wives. So together, he went with another brother. The convert tried to persuade the missionaries to accept him on those terms, and they said no. And then the people said that all the other missions tried it, but they never could build a church that way and caved into the pressure. You know what he said? He said they were wrong. They have seven churches over there. Most of them have a membership between 75 and 100 people. None less than 50, and instruction classes to as many as 75 at a time. You know, the Lord can vindicate the standing for the truth. One of the problems is that in African culture, the culture is so strong that the Bible takes second place. That sounds like American culture, doesn't it? But all these people that try to teach polygamy away never manage to stop it. The other denominations still have polygamy in their church. The church that for 60 years taught that it was wrong, they still couldn't eliminate it in the church. Why doesn't it work? Well, we'll accept you as you are. You come into the church. And then a man who has no son finally caves into the cultural pressure and gets another wife in spite of the church telling him not to. And then after a time, he comes back to the church and says he wasn't really converted before. Well, what about some objections? There's a book written by a Dr. Gaskian called Polygamy, A Cultural and Biblical Perspective that has had a good bit of influence in some circles. And I think the title of this book is quite interesting because of the order of the title, A Cultural and Biblical Perspective. Do you notice which came first in his mind? Culture was ahead of the Bible. Anyhow, there was some useful material in that book, but I cannot recommend the book, and I want to tell you a little bit about the contents of the book. In this book, many reasons are given why polygamy is practiced in Africa. Some of them are cultural. It allows widows to get back into families, and thus loneliness is avoided. It's an obligation to guarantee the continuation of the clan, and thus avoid being cursed by God and also achieving a kind of eternal life. It's to provide marriage and children for every adult female. It's to guarantee support and care for aged parents, which is facilitated by having many male children. Provides enough workers for the farm and the home. Sometimes a wife requests another wife to share the work. A desire to obtain a male descendant if his first wife is barren or has not produced sons. It can compensate for the loss of children through sickness and death. There's a desire to have many males to defend the clan. Provides a family setting with children for childless wives. And it fits the cultural view that every woman should be married. The practice of levirate marriage and having multiple wives is a state symbol denoting power and wealth. There are family reasons too. Automatic backup wife and mother in case the first wife dies or is sick. It provides for a wife and children for a husband in different locations due to nomadic migrations or widely separated farms. You know, everywhere he goes, he's got a wife. And there are sinful reasons. Men are lustful and desire to have sex with more than one woman. There's a desire for wealth and power and status. Polygamy enables you to have more children, and wealth comes to the father through dowries for female children. And the first wife is glad if her husband has an additional wife to provide for his sexual demands. And then the practice in Africa of female genital mutilation destroys a wife's desire for the sexual relationship except for the conception of children. Do you notice that the vast majority of these reasons are either perverted, directly opposed to the revealed will of God, or based on a false concept of marriage, or a wrong concept of how to deal with adversities and changes of life? You know, cultural reasons for sin do not justify continuing in that sin. This book never addresses Ezra's revival. And he says it's hypocrisy to baptize former adulterers and fornicators and deny it to polygamists, since polygamists were more honorable than they. Well, who says a polygamist is more honorable? The question is whether someone continues in sin, not the degree of former sins. You can baptize former adulterers and former fornicators and former polygamists and former murderers and former who knows what. People who have forsaken their sin. That's the point of Christianity. Jesus said, anyone comes after me, he must forsake everything he has and follow. And then this author lists a threefold sin in a Christian taking a second wife. He breaks his solemn wedding vow of monogamy. It's an act of rebellion against God's revealed will. It's a betrayal of his first wife. And it is adultery and should be handled like adultery. He then follows by quoting Paul's action in 1 Corinthians 6 and recommends excommunication. Now the answer to that is that adultery is not defined by your conversion date. And then he continues the discussion by saying that although turning one over to Satan may seem harsh, it is appropriate for two reasons. The testimony of the church in the midst of a pagan society. Well, first of all, the pagan society looking on won't distinguish between pre-conversion polygamy and post-conversion polygamy. And also, he says, dealing effectively with a strong pull of sexual sin and the unwillingness of people to let it go. And then he goes on to say that if such a person moves to another place and later comes back repentant, he would be counseled to continue as best and loving as he can. That's confusion. The answer is, this is a marriage issue. And remember, marriage is given to humanity, not to Christians per se. And so whether something or not is adultery or not has nothing to do with your conversion date. It is just as wrong to continue polygamy as it is to start polygamy. The biggest weakness in this book is it failed to answer the question of whether polygamy is adultery in the New Testament. Now here's an objection that people raise. They say, well, in 2 Samuel chapter 12, God speaks of giving David's master's wives into his bosom. If polygamy was adultery, then God would be condoning adultery. Well, first of all, you need to study the cultural background of that. And in the Old Testament, the wives of the deceased king were entrusted into the custody of his successor. And if such widows were to marry another, any descendant would be a threat to the throne. And that explains why Solomon was so alarmed at the schemes of Adonijah regarding Abishag. However, in spite of all that, polygamy was not counted as adultery in the Old Testament. And so this doesn't even address the question of whether polygamy is adultery in the New Testament. And besides, you can refute this by context. 2 Samuel 12, verse 11. God says, I'm going to give your wives to your neighbor. Does that mean God approves of wife swapping? No, that was an action of judgment. Matthew 5:32. Here's another argument. Jesus condemns divorce as adultery, but says not a word about polygamy. Well, in Jesus' day, apparently, polygamy was not so much an issue among the common people. And so it's likely that Jesus was not addressing it. You can see that polygamy was acknowledged and regulated in Old Testament law, but practice of it after the captivity, we have practically no record. In fact, someone made an interesting point regarding the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs is notably silent regarding polygamy. Here's a quote. While kings allowed themselves the doubtful luxury of polygamy, the ordinary Israelite seldom resorted to it. And in Proverbs, the union of one man with one woman is clearly shown to be the norm, both by the absence of any allusion to the discords of polygamy, though we meet other domestic troubles from unfaithfulness to nagging, and by the fully personal bond taken to exist between husband and wife. The two share the children's training and are assumed to speak with one voice, chapter 1, verses 8 and 9, chapter 6, verse 20, etc. Towards his partner, the man is urged to not merely be loyal, but ardent, ravished always with her love, chapter 5, verse 19. And a broken marriage vow is a sin against an old comrade, chapter 2, verse 17. The word here is alup, always a term for the closest of friends. You can compare some references. This is a far cry from the not uncommon ancient idea of a wife as childbearer but no companion. On her constructive womanly wisdom chiefly depends the family stability, chapter 14, verse 1. Now, this argument from silence, see, people say, well, Jesus didn't say anything about polygamy, so therefore it must be okay. Well, you know, Jesus did not address concubinage either. So does that mean concubinage is okay? Would that be all right if we had concubines today? And similarly, how many preachers have you heard in your lifetime that have you ever heard explicitly preach against polygamy? Should we then claim that all those men that have never said a word about polygamy being wrong were condoning the practice of existing polygamy? You can see how weak this argument is. You know, why do people gravitate toward those kind of arguments? It's because they don't have strong arguments. Here's another argument somebody has used. In polygamy, a man becomes one with his first wife. Then this oneness also becomes one with the second wife. Now, wait a bit. You know, the New Testament raises a higher standard of marriage than the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, a man shall leave father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh, Genesis 2:24. God created a pair in Eden, not multiple women. It wasn't Adam and Eve and Sarah. Only the two were joined. But later, man perverted marriage. And the Old Testament allowed man to have multiple marriage. But in the New Testament, when Jesus and Paul quote this verse, Genesis 2:24, they change it. Have you noticed that? They change it. They insert the two. Thus shall a man leave father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. You see, the way it's worded in the Old Testament, it doesn't specifically narrow it down to two. In fact, in Mark 10, verse 8, the emphasis is on moving from two to one. And the two shall become one flesh, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. And so, the New Testament explicitly emphasizes the two becoming one in contrast to the Old Testament. Someone will ask this, doesn't the separation of polygamous unions involve so many practical and social difficulties that the losses are greater than the gains? And the answer is, the issue is whether the union is adulterous. If the union is adulterous, the losses in staying together will always be greater losses than are gained. And those losses will percolate into many areas, corrupting many. Have you ever thought about this? When Noah entered the ark, even for the unclean animals and birds, only pairs went into the ark. Now, as a matter of efficiency, multiple females would help replenish the earth much faster. You know, some people think that for practical reasons, we cannot do what the scriptures imply. Actually, for practical reasons, we cannot afford to miss doing what the scriptures imply. Well, when Peter preached in Acts 2, some might say, he did not question them about polygamy. My answer to that is, how do you know? Were you there? Do you have a full recording of everything that was said? And maybe polygamy wasn't an issue in his particular audience at that time. It's an argument from silence. In fact, the record itself actually spoke of incompleteness, because after additional detailed exhortation, those who received the word were baptized, Acts 2, verse 40. Well, on an issue as important as polygamy, since the New Testament does not explicitly address it, should we not also be silent? Remember that in the Old Testament, murder was prohibited in the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. But military application of deadly force was specifically commanded of believers in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 20, verses 16 and 17. It is only by implication is it prohibited in the New Testament. There is no one verse that you can point to that specifically prohibits a Christian from taking up deadly military force against another human being. But there is plenty in the New Testament that implies that he should not do that. Similarly, would anybody dare to claim that single men can look and lust for all they please at single girls? Because Jesus, when he says, whoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery already in his heart, the implication is he is talking about specifically married men looking at other girls. And so there, single men can look and lust all they please. Or that ladies can look and lust all they please because Jesus never makes an issue of it. And he's speaking to the men. He makes an issue of it for them, but not for the ladies. Obviously not. Similarly, you can't go to Exodus 21 and say that, well, since it says you, here's the rule for if you steal a sheep or an ox, but it doesn't say anything about donkeys, so I can steal a donkey and I don't have to worry about ever paying it back. You see, in the New Testament, divorce does not dissolve a marriage, and that is clear by implication. And similarly, by implication, polygamy is forbidden in the New Testament. Now, even unbelievers clearly understand implications, and so should we. Now, we're not talking about inferences here. We're talking about implications. You know, if somebody says, well, I agree that that triangle has two angles in it that are equal, but I don't agree that it has two sides that are equal. That'll never work. Because if you have two angles in a triangle that are equal, it's called a isosceles triangle. It's not called that, but it will produce one. In other words, if you have two equal angles, you're guaranteed two equal sides. And so a person might believe one piece of it, but if you believe that piece, it guarantees the rest of it. For example, you can run it the other way. If you have two sides of a triangle that are equal, that's called an isosceles triangle. And then that guarantees that two angles are equal. And a person might say, well, I don't agree that two angles are equal. That doesn't change a thing. The implication of two sides being equal makes it implied that two angles are guaranteed equal. And the same kind of thing is true here. Even unbelievers understand implications. For example, remember how God said, how can we get Ahab to go up there to Ramoth-Gilead and be killed? That big discussion in heaven. And a bunch of evil spirits were talking. And one of them said, I'll be a lying spirit to all of his prophets. God said, go ahead. So he went down and he was a lying spirit to those prophets. And those fellows said, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper. And Jehoshaphat was there and he said, well, isn't there a prophet of the Lord here? And Ahab said, wow, you know, this is Micaiah fellow and I hate him. He always says bad stuff about me. And Jehoshaphat, don't say that. Bring him in here. So he brought him in there. And Micaiah said, I saw Israel scattered like sheep without a shepherd. And Ahab instantly knew what that meant. He said, see, didn't I tell you? Always says evil about me. In other words, what was the implication? That Ahab would be killed. And Ahab knew that instantly. You know, we need to start as Christians paying more attention to what the New Testament implies. You can't just say, oh, I believe this certain thing, without automatically embracing the consequences of that thing. And there are many false doctrines that people believe. And they say, oh, I believe this. But you start pushing and say, all right, if you believe that, that means this and this and this. You believe this? Oh, no, I don't believe that. You're pushing me too hard. Wait a minute. If you said you believe this, that guarantees you believe that, whether you think you believe it or not. And if you are sure you don't believe it, do you know what that means? That means that you really don't believe this thing you said you believe in the beginning. Well, why did God allow polygamy and divorce and remarriage in the Old Testament and not now? Acts 17:30. It was a time of ignorance. He let go for multiple marriages. Now he commands all men everywhere to repent. In the Old Testament, some of the regulations were restrictions of evil behavior that people would do. The divorce regulation, God was restricting the evil behavior regarding divorce. Some people say this. Polygamy is an African problem. The new believers in Africa should decide what to do. You know, that is a false statement. Because polygamy is not an African problem. It is a global problem. Aberrant marriage is a global problem. Polygamy is aberrant marriage, whether it's in Utah or whether it's in Africa. And the push for legalized homosexual marriage, as they call it, is going to help usher in legalized polygamy and polyamory in America. Polyamory is group marriage. If you want to read about it, you can look up the Weekly Standard in August of 2003. The people who want to have group marriage, the people who want polygamy legalized in this country, they're using as a handle the homosexual thing. Because if people are going to allow homosexuals to get married, well then why can't somebody else redefine marriage and say, I want to have three wives. And somebody else says, well, I'd like, me and my buddy would like to together have two wives and or four wives or whatever. Let's have group marriage. Adultery is not defined by geography. I believe missionaries are to teach all things Christ commanded, whether explicitly or by implication. Now notice again, implication is vastly different from inference. Implication is, here's something that we know as a fact, and then that fact produces a second fact that wasn't explicitly stated. That's implication. I think this is also refuted by the example of the Apostle Paul, 1 Corinthians 11, verse 16. Apparently, the Christian woman's covering was commonly practiced in churches, but Paul did not just leave it up to the Corinthians to figure out what to do about it. He wrote explicit and detailed instructions on it and insisted on obedience. Some people have said regarding this issue of polygamy that these people are ignorant of the New Testament, and they've been living in an Old Testament-type setting. You know, ignorance of the New Testament does not put us into the Old Testament covenant. The Old Testament covenant ended with Christ. The central issue is the issue of the two covenants. No one today who's alive on this earth is under the Old Covenant. Jesus said, if I had not come and spoken to them, they would have no sin, but now they have no excuse for their sin, John 15:22. All men are going to be judged by Christ's words in the last day, John 12:48. Well, we need to teach against polygamy, some will say, but allow time for the individual to come to that conclusion while we accept him fully as a member of the church. Well, remember Ezra chapter 10. Spiritual revival called for immediate decision. You know, an analogous situation is the issue of believer's baptism. If the church teaches about believer's baptism and then tells the people, after this study, you come to your own conclusion. If you still feel your infant baptism was fine, that's fine with us. What's the result? The operational result is not clear teaching against it. You know, I believe people need to understand and count the cost and know what it will involve to be united to the body of believers. Somebody will say, well, if we make an issue of polygamy, aren't we categorizing sins and calling some big sins and some little sins? What about the man in the congregation that just gets angry? The fact is that some sins are worse than others. Hating a brother is counted by God as what? Murder. But it's even worse to actually kill the man, isn't it? See, I'm not saying that hating is not counted as murder, but it's even worse to add to it by killing the man, and that affects the family in a much more drastic way. Similarly with lustful looks and outright adultery. They're both wrong. They're both sin. We need to preach and teach against all existing sin, lust, anger, adultery, whatever. And if a brother says, I'm not going to put this away, then he needs to be dealt with, and he can't remain in the fellowship by insisting on his own way instead of Christ's way. Because Christ says, come to me and forsake all of your own opinions. Christ says, I will be Lord of all or not at all. Well, this approach in a Muslim culture will force the dismissed wives into prostitution. That's what another argument is. The exact same argument would be even more against ever presenting the gospel to a Muslim woman whose husband was a staunch Muslim, because he would beat her up and throw her out. A believing husband who dismisses his wife out of obedience to Christ but still provides for her definitely does not force her into prostitution. And besides, if there's another Christian in the area, which is obviously true if there's a missionary there, such a wife is not forced into prostitution, because the church is obligated by Christ to care for the destitute. And the church would devise a way to help that woman make a living. You see, it's not the divorce that causes adultery, but improper marriage. And so the dismissed wife would actually be eligible for marriage to a believer who in the pagan culture would not have had opportunity for a wife, because the rich old guys have snatched up all the young ladies. Well, if we use this approach in missions, we'll offend many people. I believe we may need to make a clear distinction between my offending someone and Christ offending. Christ says many will be offended because of him. And one of the reasons why so many missions allow existing polygamy in Africa or other places is because those very missions, their churches at home in America, allow serial polygamy at home. A man divorces his wife, marries someone else, and that's fine. Just say you're sorry you did it. Well, no wonder they have no moral voice. No wonder they would feel very strange telling this fellow, you can't have all these wives. They have no moral voice for declaring the truth clearly. Well, what if a church has no men who qualify for leadership because of these marriage tangles? It's clear that in the New Testament, there were churches that were existing and functioning even without proper leadership. How do we know? Because Paul commanded Titus to appoint elders in every city. In other words, I believe you could appoint interim directors that are clearly temporary until proper elders could be raised up, and emphasize that you're doing it on this procedure to be obedient to the Scripture. Well, how about a former polygamist who was separated from adulterous unions? Should he be allowed to be an elder? I believe that he would need to provide for former wives, and he would not be a one-woman man as described there in Timothy. Now, when we see the grand picture of the New Testament, compare it with the Old Testament, you can see that Christ raised the standard and brought it back to the original thing of one man and one woman. And I believe that is our job to do in terms of our own personal marriage, and in terms of the fellowship, and in terms of a testimony to society. May the Lord bless you as you focus on what God has to say and help each other grow in His grace and wisdom.